We're talking tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on today's News Talk, TNT.
Thank you for joining me for another edition of Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd here on TNT Radio Live, where we look at this incredible technological journey and where it's taking us next. Now, before we get to the tech news, we need to note the fact that Twitter, or X, has multiple reports right now that Iran is attacking Israel and that US warnings to Iran to not attack have obviously gone unheeded. Now, before I came on air, I checked various online newspapers in Australia and globally, and none seem to have this as headline news as yet. But if this attack escalates, this could obviously be a major news story with global impacts. And just looking at my Twitter feed right now, there's reports that 50 missiles have been launched by Hezbollah towards northern Israel, that Israel has retaliated, that the Iron Dome is down. Sometimes on Twitter or on X, you get news that isn't necessarily accurate, but could be prescient. So look, obviously, Jason Olborn, who was on before me, has been covering this story, and Lambert Opik, who will be on directly after this show at 10 a.m. London time and 7 p.m. in Sydney, will be looking at this in much greater depth. And I'll be asking my guest about AI in warfare too. So do stay tuned to tntradio.live through the morning, afternoon, and evening for more updates on this breaking situation. Obviously, any such war could also have major implications for the global tech industry. I mean, Israel is home to a number of global tech companies, or they have big offices there. Intel in particular is one of those. So this definitely isn't a good situation, and one can only hope this does not escalate into World War III. Now, before we get to our guest, the latest tech news revolves around the topics of AI, which could now see a major derailment should this war get even hotter. So in this week, Intel, which makes most of the chips that are in today's Windows PCs, is joining forces with ARM, which designs the processors that companies like Qualcomm, Samsung, Apple, Texas Instruments, Google, previously Huawei, and others have their own custom designs for. Now, TSMC is the Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company, itself under threat should China attack Taiwan, and they manufacture most of these designs. Although with Huawei banned from using TSMC, their processors are made by a Chinese chip maker called SMIC, or Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation. Samsung has its own plants to make chips, and while many of those chips of their phones actually use Qualcomm Snapdragon processors made in Taiwan, it also manufactures its own chips, which are called Exynos. And they even make the Google Tensor chips that Google has for its Pixel smartphones. They're quite a force as well. So what is ARM's deal with Intel? Well, for Intel to be able to manufacture chips based on the ARM architecture, they need to expand the number of places and countries that can make ARM-powered processors. And Intel has actually made chips designed with ARM designs for years. But this deal will give Intel's foundries, two of which are being built in the US at a cost of $20 billion, more chips to make. Now, TSMC has received $6.6 billion from the Biden administration towards its much-delayed 3 and 4 nanometer chip foundries in Arizona. So while we went from a drought of chips during the pandemic, the second half of this decade should see even more chips being manufactured than ever before, which the world will need considering the AI boom currently underway will need ever more computing power to satisfy the ever-growing demand. Now, in other AI chip news, Intel has also announced a new AI chip called the Gaudi 3. And this is designed to compete directly with the NVIDIA H100, as well as AMD's MI300X. And Intel expects its chip to deliver 50% faster training time, and it's projected to outperform the H100 from NVIDIA by 50% on average. Now, these chips are due in June, which isn't that far away, and this is months before NVIDIA's recently announced successor to the N100 chips are due to be commercially available. Well, it's now time to introduce Curtin University's Alex Jenkins. He is the director of the Western Australia Data Science Innovation Hub, part of Curtin University, to explore how AI is reshaping not only the traditional paradigms of AI in education, but whether AI will take our jobs, change the outcome of elections, and much more. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Alex. Very glad to be here.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. Now, before we look at the various aspects of the way that AI is changing the ways that we learn, work, play, and live life, and before we look at Curtin University's just released first short film in a new six-part series, Alex, given Twitter reports that Iran is firing missiles upon Israel, how is AI being used in warfare? And has it already been used in war for years, or is it now really going to see a massive acceleration?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting and important topic. So we have seen some elements of artificial intelligence being used in defense situations and warfare for many years, through from target identification through to target guidance and also situational awareness, as well as many other different areas. But I think it's important to delineate some of these things which might be more accurately classed as signal processing or signal classification algorithms that use machine learning. And so for your audience that don't know, AI is a product of technology that we call machine learning, which uses neural networks, a certain type of software that learns based on data. And what we've really seen in the artificial intelligence world is that this type of technology being scaled up to a huge degree. And that's where we get things like ChatGPT or Bing or the Google Gemini. So it's going to be a really interesting and quite a dangerous time when this type of AI starts to be used in defense and warfare situations. And what I am most concerned about is when humans start deferring the decision to end a human life or attack a target to a machine, because that will dramatically change how warfare works, how it is operated, and perhaps most importantly, the impact that will have on someone who is commanding an attack to happen, but doesn't have to consciously make that decision to attack a building with a certain number of people where they know that innocent lives are at risk. And so that human psychology element of it, I think, is extremely important. It will be very tempting to defer these decisions to AI and to machines. And that will cheapen the decision to end a human life, I think. And that is a very scary future. And I think the way that we manage that internationally is something that we need to discuss.
Yes, well, I mean, we have heard of reports of autonomous drones, and even when Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, was on stage, he had 9 different AI-powered robots on stage, which, you know, they look a bit harmless, like the robots from iRobot, the movie with Will Smith. But of course, we know those robots weren't bad, and, you know, they're not quite as evil-looking as the Terminator. But it's not a stretch to imagine these sorts of autonomous AI-powered robots roaming around with, you know, lasers or machine guns or whatever it might be. I mean, I'm sure if they get hit by a missile, they'll probably disintegrate quite readily. But I've seen a bipedal robot being sort of viciously attacked by its creators to see if they could make it topple over, and the robot is sort of stumbling and upright again. So, I mean, war often makes technology accelerate, and sadly looks like this is going to happen again in the second half of this decade.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. So I am less worried about, let's call it the Terminator scenario, where the AI goes bad and sort of turns against us. I don't see that in the short term, at least, as a realistic threat. What is far more dangerous, I think, is if we have these robots and they get smart enough where we can say we issue a command to secure an area, and then the robots take it upon themselves to make decisions about targets, to make decisions about when and where to use force. And they clear the conscience of the commander who no longer has to take on that responsibility of potentially using force and putting civilian lives at risk. That, I think, is a situation that is very real. If it's not already happening now, will be happening into the future. And is much more likely than this situation with AI sort of turning against its owners. So it's important for people to understand that what we understand about artificial intelligence through technologies like ChatGPT This AI works like a subset of our brain, the language processing areas of our brain. And these AIs don't have emotions. They don't even have a self-defense mechanism. They don't, all of these instincts that humans have that are necessary for our survival, and that we use to defend ourselves and also to attack others. AI doesn't have any of these instincts. It doesn't have an endocrine system. It doesn't get angry. And so this idea that it could sort of turn against us, I think, is unrealistic. Much more concerned about how the human decision-making process will be cheapened with artificial intelligence when we don't have to make that conscious decision to put a civilian life at risk and we defer that decision to a machine.
Well, look, as I was saying before, there'll be much more throughout the day with Lembit Opik and the rest of the TNT Radio.live host team to look at this, but in sort of more uplifting AI news and discussion, Curtin University has just released the first of a six-part video series on AI. That first video is released earlier this week, and I actually have the video in full at my website, techadvice.life. I mean, you can go online and look for it, but it's much easier to find it there. So, Alex, what does this new series explore? I mean, we'll look at the first minute of this in a moment, but what does the new series explore? When will new episodes arrive? And where can people watch new episodes?
Yes. So these videos, they're absolutely fantastic. So the person who's really been running this, Matt Reed, is within Curtin University. And the idea here was to create something that really showcased the fact that Curtin was accepting that artificial intelligence is going to be a part of the future, that Curtin is a place where AI will be embraced, and trying to find that balance between obviously the fact that we will all be using artificial intelligence in the workplace very soon. And so it's vitally important that students and staff are trained and understand how to use it. There's this stereotype out there that artificial intelligence, particularly in an educational setting, will just be used for cheating. And so we need to move beyond that. It's a bit like when, you know, calculators came out and everyone thought it was the end of mathematics. That is definitely not the case. And it's the same for artificial intelligence and education. So these videos will be released gradually in the coming weeks. You'll be able to find them on the Curtin websites and the Curtin social media. But they're really exploring how AI is changing both teaching and learning inside the university and research.
Well, we're going to discuss a lot more about this right now, but let's watch the first minute of this first episode and then we can talk more about it.
What should students know? How should they be thinking about their approach to university in an AI world, in a world where some people might think, hey, can I blag this whole bloody thing?
There's no point in going through your university degree and having the artificial intelligence do the work for you and then coming out of it and not having learned anything. That's not what we're here for.
So the future of work is changing. We know this because that's all anyone's talking about. I mean, if you don't know about AI, you've been living under a rock.
Artificial intelligence could have some of the biggest impacts to education that we see in our lifetime. Will absolutely change the quality of education that we can provide and highly personalize education for all students worldwide.
How we should consider AI in the creative process, it should be used in a way where it trains you, it pushes you, it challenges you. You know, the minute it becomes a crutch, you know, then I think then it's not worth even using it.
Look, as I was saying, you can watch the rest of that on my website, techadvice.life, but also, as Alex was saying, at the Curtin University website and on the Curtin social media platform. So, Alex, what sort of feedback have you received over the last few days since this first episode was made public?
I'm really excited to learn about what we are doing inside Curtin University with AI. And also, with, you know, having requests from students about how they might use AI. So that's been really positive because the goal of these videos is to ensure that students understand that Curtin is a place where AI will be embraced. Many universities have really started their discussion around AI just in terms of plagiarism. And I think that that's a really narrow way to look at artificial intelligence. And, you know, we need to embrace artificial intelligence as a part of education going into the future. I personally think it will enrich education. I think that it will enrich individual students' learning. I see a future where every student has an AI tutor that's able to explain things to them in a way that is perfectly suited to their level of knowledge and their style of learning. And that this is a really great future and a quite an empowering future. And even a future where we really see some equalization in terms of the educational outcomes that people can achieve regardless of their socioeconomic background or where they've been brought up. So I see artificial intelligence as a something that's really empowering education, just as much as the internet did, probably even more. So this is it's been great to get that feedback from both students and members of the public.
Well, we've got another 40 minutes to discuss all of this. We need to take a quick break. So why not give TNT Radio a follow? We are on all the major social platforms, including Facebook, X, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Please help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk, TNT. See you after the break.
TNT's Pella Nuroff-Taylor.
All this about the far right. I mean, don't forget, what is now called far right was normal in Europe until the sort of big explosion or the big change in the European elite's view towards migration until about 97 or 2000. It was normal to have a zero net migration. I mean, that was not far right. It was moderate. And then the borders have shifted, the goalposts have shifted for the politicians, but not for the voting public. So I wouldn't call it a far right position to
That's
hold.
That's right. It was supposed to be, Europe was supposed to be, I mean, I remember it being likened to an egg. In other words, a hard shell on the outside, but completely fluid on the inside. That was the dream of the common European home.
Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Thank you again for joining us. So, Alex, how is Curtin University already using AI to change the way that it educates students, given that we've been in the ChatGPT era now since November 2022, be it in terms of more personalized education, which you just spoke about, or in other ways?
Yeah, so there's a few things happening. One of the things that we're looking at inside the university and actively testing is some chatbot tools that allow people to ask questions about the university, ask questions about their classes. And the key for us then is to maintain all of that data so that we can see the kind of queries that students are asking which aren't being answered by the AI, and so we can build up something more useful. So there's very early testing happening in that space. And so that would give you a bit of an early AI assistant for the university. So I'm really excited. If you think about where this will go, is a AI assistant. You come to university, you say, hey, who are the academics I should talk to? I'm really interested in electronic engineering. Okay, you need to see, you know, Professor X, Y, and Z. You know, what are the student clubs that I should consider joining? So we're really heading this towards this direction where we use AI as a way to help students be guided through their learning. I'd love to see that extended into something that also acts as a way to monitor and help improve their academic progress. So something that an AI tutor that is really empowered to understand the units and the degrees that students are studying and help them along that way. So the technology is almost there. Like I said, we've started testing a tool where people can answer questions about what's happening inside the university. And we can collect that data. And the more data we obviously collect, the more we can improve that service and do it in a responsible way in terms of the data collection. So that's just one of the ways. We've also started something called the Curtin AI and Research Group, which I am chairing. And the idea is that we can accelerate research inside the university using artificial intelligence. So some of the most amazing use cases in AI aren't just happening in the computer science and engineering areas, they're happening in molecular biology and healthcare. And in fact, one AI in particular, AlphaFold, is able to solve a very specific problem in molecular biology. Used to take a PhD student 3 years to solve what we call one protein, but now only takes a few seconds. So I'm really proud to lead a part of the university where we are really looking to see, okay, how do we take these techniques and apply them to other domains? Because they're like power tools, they're superpowers. And if we can do that, we can dramatically increase the impact that researchers will have.
Okay, so let's talk about one thing that everybody is worried about, that AI will take your job. And we just discussed at the top of the program how we're worried that AI will take the job of soldiers and the chain of command and all those responsibilities. So is this a genuine fear that AI will take your job, or will AI free us from the drudgery of repetitive tasks, creating many more jobs and free humanity to work on higher value projects? And then, of course, what would those higher value projects be?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and it's a question I am asked a lot. I think I don't see AI as causing unemployment. I think for the last 100 years, we've had technological leaps and bounds, and every time we've seen these life-changing technologies enter our lives, people have been worried about what it means for their jobs. Now, the reality is that AI will change jobs. Some jobs will go away, but new jobs will be created. Now, if you think it was only a few hundred years ago, almost all of us, about 85% of the population, were farmers. We had to be farmers. And then as we moved to more mechanized agriculture and more efficient means of agricultural, a lot of these jobs went away in agriculture because we didn't have to do them anymore. So I'm really excited about what our jobs look like into the future. I absolutely admit there are certain jobs at the moment which are likely to go. If you ask me which ones, I would say the job of being a call center operator for a large organization is something that probably won't exist too much longer into the future, I think. I think most of those types of jobs will be replaced by AI. But I think it will change what we do. I am not concerned about things like art and music, AI replacing musicians or artists. I think that these are really powerful tools to empower musicians and artists. And it's similar to the change that we saw in terms of, people using a pencil and paper to draw versus creating art on a computer. And there's more demand for graphic designers and computer artists now than there ever has been before. I don't see that changing in the artistic sphere as well.
Although that said, I mean, people are now creating art and logos and graphics with AI. And in fact, there's an AI program called Suno, Suno.com, that a friend and I were playing with, and we asked it to create a song. And within 30 seconds, it had created a song, and it can do it in various different styles. And if you didn't know that it was made by AI, you would just assume that it was some song that someone had made. And so, obviously AI is going to get smarter. Hopefully it won't have us sitting, as the famous science fiction novel predicted, just with folded hands and not able to do anything else as AI and AI-powered robots decide that they want to keep us safe, as their dictates may tell them.
So that's interesting that you mentioned about Suno. So one important thing to understand how AI works is that it really, if let's say a music generation AI, it is trained on thousands of hours of existing music to be able to create that music. And one side effect of that is that it's unlikely to create something that's really new and original. Mm. So if you are a mediocre, artist or someone who really lacks original ideas, then absolutely, yes, your job is, or your you are likely to be in trouble from the AI. But what will really be valued is originality and original work. And certainly humans have a massive advantage in that field, at least at the current point in time. So I see a different kind of situation where, let's say lower quality music or lower quality art, like hotel art, you know, the kind of art that ends up in hotel rooms, it's not a masterpiece. That kind of thing, I can see that being created by AI, but there'll be more work and more value placed upon human created artwork that is original, because that is something that the current generations of AI cannot do.
Yes, in discussions that I've had, I've talked about how people will be boasting and celebrating the fact that they've got human-made goods and services and ideas. And yes, the regurgitation machines that we have now definitely need more and more human input. So there's, I agree with you. There's not a big concern just yet. 20, 30, 40 years down the track, we'll have to wait and see if we have thinking machines that can be original, but not in the short term. But then what are the claims that the misuse of AI will change the outcome of elections, let alone wars, as we were discussing before, thanks to deep fakes of audio and video, or even using malicious AI systems to infiltrate electronic voting systems or the centralized computers that the votes are ultimately tabulated in?
Yeah, so this is something where I'm not concerned about jobs, and I see that we will go through a transition with jobs. This is something that I am really quite worried about. So the abuse of artificial intelligence technology to influence people is already happening. It is very real, and it can be made significantly more powerful. So I'd like you to imagine a situation where you open your Instagram feed and there's a video from Donald Trump or Joe Biden, and it is individually tailor-made to you based on your profile, your interests, your age group, your gender, all kinds of data about you. And this technology is possible today. It'd be possible to create a fake video that looks very real and addresses your concerns as a voter almost directly. And that video would be entirely fake. It would be individually made and crafted for you. And so you would watch this video and think, wow, this guy really, really appeals to me. And it is based entirely on the data that's available about you on the internet and through social media. And so that kind of thing is already possible. And I expect to see it used at scale into the future as part of election campaigns. Now, already as well, it's possible to flood social media with posts using artificial intelligence. And it's getting harder and harder to distinguish between artificial intelligence created content in that domain of social media versus real humans. So very real psychological impacts that AI can be used for persuasion. I think that that is more the biggest risk. I see, the use of artificial intelligence as a hacking tool is obviously very real for all parts of our digital infrastructure and economy. I don't see, the ability for it to attack voting machines as any more dangerous than, say, other parts of our infrastructure. I think that the psychological impact, again, that interface between AI and humans is something where we'll see a real impact. And to be persuaded to vote a particular way, because you watched an AI video, I think that that is we're going to enter that world very, very soon if we're not already there.
Yeah, certainly the videos that are being created today are just of incredible quality. I mean, originally they were fuzzy, the mouth wasn't moving properly. It's a little bit like the original phishing emails full of spelling mistakes and other problems. Now the bad guys are using AI to make those websites look virtually perfect, to correct all the spelling mistakes and the grammar errors. And it's just a sign of the times that AI is getting much more advanced and can help us to clone reality so effortlessly, which is, as you say, quite a concern. Now, which flavor of AI does Curtin University currently favor? Is it OpenAI's ChatGPT, or are you working with all of the major players and the new AI engines that are emerging?
Yeah, so we work with multiple vendors in that space for different applications. One thing I think is really important for universities to do as well is to actually be able to run their own artificial intelligences and train their own artificial intelligences. Mm. we don't want to be dependent on a small number of mega corporations in terms of what AIs we are using. And that's true for a number of reasons. Firstly, I think it is a dangerous precedent if we, you know, defer what we're allowed to do with an AI to someone like Microsoft or Google. I think it's not for them to make the rules about how we use an AI. That should be something that's done locally within our own countries, within our own jurisdictions, by our own governments. So we are making that decision, not a corporate entity. The other thing that's quite interesting is that there is a real risk that AI is monopolized by a very small number of players. As we see, and as you talked about at the start of the show, companies like NVIDIA really are controlling the computational horsepower that drives all of these AIs. Now, if it's the case that OpenAI, for instance, always have the most powerful AI, that is not a great situation for the world for many reasons. We really want healthy competition between the large tech players, but we also want a thriving open source ecosystem where AI models can be trained on different data sets, trained on different perspectives, different cultures. There's no such thing as the objective truth, I would argue, when it comes to how we talk about information and knowledge around the world. So it is really important that we have multiple different AIs. Now, there's also a really good scientific reason that we should have these AIs not centralize the power of artificial intelligence. And that's, I'd like you to imagine a situation where AIs are like people. And if we just use the OpenAI GPT-4 and everyone uses GPT-4, it's going to regurgitate the same ideas left, right, and center. But one of the most incredible things about the human mind is that we're all a bit different. And our training data sets, which is our knowledge and experience, is different. So when I communicate an idea to you, I have this idea in my head. It's wrapped up in my context and my experience. I convert that idea into sound waves, like I am doing now, which I communicate to you. And I hope, I cross my fingers and I hope that it will be reinflated in your head in some semblance of way that that I thought about the idea. But the essence of that miscommunication or you interpreting an idea differently to me is really important. That's how new ideas are formed, and that's how we have a conversation and why we have a conversation. So I think it's super important that we have AIs that are very different, that can talk to each other, because that will be a fantastic way to even study communication and study how new ideas and information is born. So I think it's super important that we have a very healthy, competitive mix of different AIs out in the world.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I'm very happy to see the open source community really banding together to build a number of these large language models in open source format. And also the move to seeing open source being run on people's individual computers so that those large language models, that generative AI, is happening locally rather than, and with, you know, with privacy and speed and accuracy right on our devices rather than being sent to the cloud. But we're still in that area where, you know, the real grunt work is being done in the cloud and we don't have enough local power yet, but that is changing. We're seeing AMD and Intel and Qualcomm and Apple and others working very hard to bring AI to our personal devices. And just on the topic we spoke before about Suno, I mean, there's that's the music creator, suno.com, but there's a website called There's an AI for that.com without the apostrophe in theirs. And that has, when I first looked at that, there was under 5,000 AIs. But today, a few months later, that's got 12,239 AIs for over 15,000 tasks and nearly 5,000 different jobs. So you must have been keeping quite an eye on that side and marveling at how quickly all these different AI engines are popping up like mushrooms.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see. And I'm really excited to see how technology has changed so quickly and continues to change. I've never seen a field in computer science develop so quickly with such dramatic results and constant change and constant improvement. It is by far the most exciting time that I think we have seen in the technology world since the dawn of the internet. It really is just as big as that. I feel personally that it is bigger. We really are seeing a shift in what technology means in terms of how people use it and what it can actually do for us.
Alex, we need to take a quick break. I'd like to tell everybody, please don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store so you can easily watch or listen live to us anywhere and at any time. It's available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed on today's News Talk TNT, back after the break.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Protecting. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Alex Zaharoff-Reut is talking tech on today's News Talk, TNT.
Thank you for joining us once again here on TNTRadio.live. Now, I'm with Alex Jenkins from Curtin University. Alex, you recently gave a TED Talk in Perth, which was titled An AI Tutor for Every Child. Now, we can watch that online, and I have a link to that at my website as well, techadvice.life. But what's the synopsis of your presentation?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. So I've always really been inspired by a person called Sal Khan, who founded the Khan Academy. Now, the Khan Academy is this incredible resource for educators, for students, for parents, that really provides lots of educational material. And Sal Khan, for a long time, was focused on changing education in a way through something called the mastery method, where if you think about mathematics, a lot of students have a very bad experience in maths as they go through school. And mathematics is like building a house. You have to build the foundations first. And then once the foundations are set, you need to, you know, put more bricks on top. And if you do that, you can have a very strong and stable foundation in your mathematical education. But what actually happens in school is that most students will learn algebra for 3 weeks or fractions for a few weeks. And then regardless of whether they've mastered that topic or not, the whole class moves on to the next topic. And so this is how classroom education has worked for over 100 years. And the problem with this is that it means we move through the curriculum without students having an absolute mastery of the topics at hand. And that causes them to build a bit of a shaky house, a foundation, a very shaky foundation in mathematics. And what happens is most students eventually fail at these topics as you get more and more difficult. So Sal Khan pushed forward this idea of mastery learning, where you only move on to the next topic once you have mastered the previous one. And it is a fantastic way to learn maths. And it is really important in terms of making sure that you master all the material. And people are such confident learners when they go through like this. But as a society, we've never really been able to employ this method inside a classroom because it would require people to learn at their own paces and learn quite differently. So AI is the first sort of way that we've been able to see how we might implement this mastery method of learning at scale for all of our students in such a way that people learn at their own pace. The teacher is there to help and talk about problems, but that the AI can guide them to ensure that they have mastered a topic before they move on to the next thing. So with my TED Talk, I really tried to show how this might be possible using artificial intelligence and how it might look. And I'm really excited because we are seeing people like the Khan Academy start to employ this technology to provide tutoring, AI tutoring for every child. It will really equalize education access for people around the world, I believe.
Yes, it sounds like a wonderful way. I mean, I do remember that in the 1800s that the classrooms had all the different ages together and the older students would help the younger ones, and it was a much more of a group learning activity, and you know, different ages helped the younger people to learn. And we moved away from that when we went to the modern education system where everyone learned by ear. So AI will hopefully bring that personalized learning back again without you know, causing the older students to be held back teaching the younger ones. So let's see how that progresses. But as long as the world hasn't blown itself up in World War III, I look forward to that being a wonderful way for future generations to learn. But this also brings me to the topic of ethics. We've been hearing a lot about ethics with all the major AI companies talking about how importantly they take ethics. And of course, with the specter of war upon us and AI warfare, as we were discussing before, ethics is more important than ever. So how is Curtin University teaching not only itself, but its students about the ethical dilemmas that AI presents to us?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So just the other day, I did a lecture on how master students should be approaching artificial intelligence when it comes to their research. And so obviously, it's unethical for a student just to use AI to write an essay for them. And not only is it unethical, it's useless. Why are you paying for an education if you can just get ChatGPT to write your essay for you? But there are ways to use these technologies to empower you and to make you more productive. And the way that I think about artificial intelligence is as a personal assistant that is there to help me learn, help me take notes, help me synthesize my notes into something coherent. So Curtin is taking an approach where we need to educate students why it's unethical to just use it for plagiarism, how to use it in ways that are productive and actually help you learn and reinforce your learning. But also what's very exciting is how to use AI to assist with research. And so this is such a new area that I think that AI will supercharge how research is done inside tertiary institutions globally. And already we're seeing things like artificial intelligence being used for sentiment analysis, understanding large amounts of text. So let's say you wanted to run a study, and this is a real study that I'm referencing, which referenced the economic sentiment of over 100 million newspaper articles over the last 150 years. Now, if you tried to do a research study like that just a few years ago, wouldn't have been possible because you would have had to sit there and read 100 million newspaper articles and make a judgment about their economic sentiment. But now we have the technology to do that. So not only is AI improving the efficiency of certain research, it's making some types of research possible that weren't possible before. There's examples internationally. I think at Carnegie Mellon, people are using AIs to help with chemistry experiments, to help synthesize molecules. And the AI will go out to Google, figure out the various synthesis methods for a particular molecule that are available, come back, make a decision about how to approach that synthesis, and then even connect to the lab system. So you can see in that respect, the AI is working like a lab assistant in a way. So there are many ways that AI can be used inside a university. And I think we need to educate students. Obviously, this plagiarism thing is a big issue. It gets a lot of attention. But that's only one small aspect of what AI can do for us. And I think ultimately, it's going to be a hugely positive impact on the education space.
So how is Curtin University and how are you working with other universities in Australia and globally to share information about your AI studies, findings, and teachings?
Yes. So like I said, we have started a group called the Curtin AI in Research Group. And the idea there is to showcase what we are doing inside the university as well and the multiple different things we are doing to other members of the university and also to the world. And also as part of this group, we try and bring in use cases of other universities using AI. and showcasing how it can be used inside CURTAIN. The most exciting thing about AI is that certain techniques, certain methodologies in artificial intelligence, let's say they're relevant in theoretical physics. Those same methods will be relevant in biology, they'll be relevant in engineering, they'll be relevant in psychology. And so it really makes sense to think of AI as a set of problem-solving tools, and that when you have problems that are of a certain shape, these things, it's like finding the right jigsaw puzzle. And if you just put them in there using AI, then you can get some incredible results. And so we see, you know, amazing results when we combine the best and brightest data scientists working in computer science with health researchers working in molecular biology or geology. I'm really excited about the use of AI in the medical domain in multiple different ways. And it's really about making sure that one part of the university is aware of what the other parts of the university are doing, and really combining that science and computer science areas with life science, with education, you know, with the humanities. So yeah, it's very exciting. And that's really the function of this CURTAIN in AI research group.
Now, Alex, I do have to cross very shortly to an expert on what's happening with the situation in Israel and Iran, but what is your final message to the viewers and the listeners?
My message to viewers and listeners is try and look beyond the immediate concerns with artificial intelligence in terms of jobs, in terms of plagiarism for education, and try and think on a larger spectrum and a longer term spectrum about how these technologies can actually benefit humankind, because they have the opportunity to significantly impact how we live for the better. And I look forward to that future.
Well, Alex Jenkins, the director of Western Australia's Data Science Innovation Hub at CURTAIN University, thank you so much for your time, and I hope we can speak again in the future about this fascinating area. So thank you again.
Thanks, Alex.
Now, you're welcome. Now, it's time to cross to Shane Healy. He is a terrorism and youth justice expert. He's a former Australian Defence Force Special Operations Command intelligence operator, a former Alice Springs resident, and an Indigenous man originally from Western New South Wales. And he's going to talk to us about the situation in Bondi in Australia, where there was an attack, but also what's happening in Israel and Iran. So Shane, welcome to TNTRadio.live. We're just waiting to hear. Shane is normally heard with Chris Smith. He's a regular on Chris Smith's show, which in Australia is 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. We're just looking for Shane's feed. But Shane, thank you for joining us. Okay, no worries. It seems to have disappeared again. Sorry about that. This is the joys of live television, live radio, and live phone systems. But there has been some sort of an attack in Bondi at the Westfield shopping mall, from what I remember from seeing the news before I came on, somebody with a machete attacking a lot of people. Now, apparently that is a mental health issue not related to terrorism at this early stage. So we're yet to find out more information about that. We will no doubt have more information on TNTRadio.live. We're just trying to get through again to Shane Healy, a terrorism and youth justice expert, and he's now with us. Shane, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sorry about that. How are you going?
Good, thank you. So tell us, what's the latest, what's happening in Bondi before we cross to what's happening in Israel and Iran?
Yeah, so the latest update is the New South Wales police have just given an update. So at this stage, it is not a terrorist incident. One man entered with a knife, approximately 30 centimetres, and stabbed a number of people. On-duty New South Wales Police female officer shot and killed the offender. And then New South Wales Police had to do a thorough search of the entire Westfield Bondi premises, which they've done. It's now secure, and the homicide detectives are in there taking statements.
Now, there are reports on Twitter that Iran has, through its proxies with Hezbollah, have launched a number of missiles at northern Israel. And there are reports online on Twitter of all sorts of things happening. I haven't seen these reports on the front pages of the world's newspapers yet. Please tell us the latest.
So the Israelis launched an operation against Hezbollah in the last hours. And so there's a number of They went after a Hezbollah military leader and they killed a number of people in a compound there. Basically, everyone is in a holding pattern. They know that, I just sent a tweet out that sources inside of Iran have witnessed they're sending their one and two-way drones to air bases getting ready for that strike. One of the significance of this is they won't be using any of their aircraft, so any of their fighter craft. They'll be using drones. There's less of a strategic impact by using drones. Obviously, Israel has the Iron Dome counter battery system, which is excellent. So if they shoot a few drones down, they're not losing million-dollar planes and pilots. But there's a bit of a stalemate, or everyone's on edge, like, waiting for that strike to take place. The international community is trying to talk Iran down, you know, getting them to say, you know, don't strike back. But my biggest point is, and I've been speaking with people today, what country on earth would allow another nation to attack one of their embassies? We've just seen the same thing with the Ecuadorian embassy. So I think there's more at a geopolitical strategic space to play out. Some countries got to hold the IDF accountable for striking an embassy. You know, an embassy is a part of a nation in that, you know, Australian embassies around the world are part of Australia. Someone attacked an Australian embassy, they're attacking Australia. So it's a very complex situation that's unfolding. And as I've been talking to Chris for a number of weeks now, this is an attempt to draw the US into the conflict as a boots-on-the-ground military, because Netanyahu is fighting for his political life at the moment. He's under a number of fraud charges and investigations within the Israeli parliamentary system. There's a large number of protests within Israel. The Israeli people are focused on getting the hostages back. And they see Netanyahu more focused on keeping the war going to keep himself in power rather than focusing all his efforts on the safe rescue or ceasefire and then repatriation of those remaining hostages.
Yes, there have been reports that the Dutch embassy in Tehran is closing down on Sunday as a precaution. And of course, there were reports that the US has sent some of its aircraft carriers into the region, and they may be protecting Israel from attacks from drones. What have you heard about in regards to those assets being moved into the region?
So the US aircraft carriers have been there for a while now. They're mainly part of the Operation Prosperity Guardian, keeping the Red Sea away from Houthi attacks, the shipping lanes. And they're also very heavily engaged in the counter-ISIS missions away from Houthi attacks, the shipping lanes. And they're also very heavily engaged in the counter-ISIS missions. So the Islamic State, they didn't just re-emerge recently in Moscow. They've been regathering numbers for a number of years now. And there's about, you know, between 10 and 15,000 supporters and fighters back in Syria and Iraq. The US Central Command, based out of Baghdad on the ground, has a strike cell. Those aircraft carriers with those fighter aircraft have been engaged heavily in those operations. They won't become involved inside Gaza unless Hamas directly attack US military, any aircraft doing aid drops. The US Navy is helping those barges with humanitarian aid coming across from Cyprus. So unless they get directly attacked, the US military won't become involved overtly or majorly in the Gaza operation. There are some special forces elements and intelligence elements in supporting the IDFs, because some of those hostages are US citizens. But apart from that, those aircraft carriers are there for that purpose. The US Space Command constantly monitors all global launches, and they've previously, because the Iran proxies in Iraq have fired drones at US bases in Jordan and Iraq, the US, using their satellite system, pick up the point of origin and point of impact pretty quick. A lot of the reporting, both in the media and some of my sources in the US system, are reporting that their analysts are monitoring that. They're counting the numbers and they're looking at what different bases and which launch sites those drones are currently at, which looking at where they may go to. As soon as any of those drones go in the air, the US Space Command will report that information to any of the ground units, which is one of the reasons why when those US bases in at, say, Al Asad Air Base, which is in the Al Anbar province in Iraq, it's been hit a number of times. There's very, very, very low US casualties because the US service personnel have time to go to bunkers and are away from the ordnance that's fired.
Now, I have read that there was an attempt by both sides to come to an agreement where some of the hostages could be swapped again for some, a bit of peace for the Gazans just for a short period of time. And what I read on Twitter was that they didn't have 40 hostages to return. So what is the situation, as far as you're aware, with the hostages at the moment? They have been in captivity for the last 6 months, and there is concern that a number may no longer be alive or may have been moved into other areas or potentially even other countries.
Yeah, so they're all excellent points. And I think in my update on Wednesday with Chris, I explained that. So that is the biggest stumbling block at the moment with the ceasefire negotiations, is that Hamas are refusing to give exact numbers of how many hostages are still alive within Gaza. My information and assessment is that some of those hostages have been moved outside of Gaza. The humanitarian word with the hostages is basically elderly hostages, female hostages and children. And they're declaring that anyone of what's called a military age male is outside of that humanitarian bracket. I think that's just wordsmithing on both sides. But yes, you are correct. The biggest stumbling block at the moment in the peace process or the ceasefire process is that the Hamas isn't being forthcoming with the numbers and locations of the remaining hostages.
Now, there has also been concern for quite a number of years that Iran has been building nuclear capability. Of course, we did have the virus that was able to destroy some of Iran's capability to create the uranium to refine it. But since then, they've received a number of billions of dollars from the Biden administration, and you know they supposedly have restarted their nuclear weapon ambitions. So what is the reality of Iran actually having nuclear weapons and then launching them at Israel, which you would imagine would be complete madness, because it's not as if the nuclear explosion and fallout is going to stay in Israel. It would drift across the region and presumably make enemies of the entire Middle East against Iran.
So there's a couple of things let's unpack there. So one, the Mossad has been very active inside of Iran to stop that process. A number of years ago, the British wanted support and approval from the United States to bomb some of those sites. The problem that President Obama at the time had was he wasn't confident that they knew where all those sites were. A lot of this is actually not goes back to the Obama foreign policy. His foreign policy was to appease the Iranians. If we give them money and they promise not to try to get this technology, then they won't. They've never kept that promise, which is why the Mossad have been very active. You know, if you or your listeners Google, a number of years ago, there were a number of Iranian nuclear scientists killed, assassinated inside of Iran. And, you know, the most dangerous job on earth for a while was being a nuclear scientist living in Iran, because the Israelis were targeting them at a global level. So next one going to if the Iranians get nuclear weapons. So one of the other big issues in this is the Israelis have never confirmed they have nuclear capabilities. We all quote-unquote know that they do, but they've never acknowledged that capability. Given the distances involved, it's a one-strike option. But again, going back to the US, their Space Force, they monitor this 24/7. So every time or any time the US think that the Iranians are getting that closer to achieving that outcome, then they step in on a number of levels, both. And a lot of the sanctions that are currently in place against Iran is so they can't get the uranium and that to achieve that end state. But then countries like, Saudi Arabia and Qatar and your other conservative Sunni countries, now why are they technically or in a proxy war against Iran being a Shia country. They are both Islamic countries that view Israel as the enemy, and Israel view the entire Gold Coast Gulf region as their enemy. That's the biggest thing. So it would take the US, and it always does take the US to step in and keep these countries at bay. I don't think it's in the world's interest and best interest, and they won't allow the Iranians to have functioning nuclear weapons. And it will certainly come to a head in the next US presidency.
Well, let's hope that if Trump is re-elected, he can get the Abraham Accords back on track. Shane, we do have to take a very quick break. We've been missing out on what would normally be the news segment, so we can speak with you. If you could please stay on the line to have a chat with Lembit Opik. He will be on directly after the break. Thank you for joining me on the show. This is TNTRadio.live. Stick around for more with Lembit Opik.